Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. The Mark Steiner Show, support for the Mark Steiner Show, comes in part from the Maryland State Education Association. The Maryland Dream Act assures kids who graduated from a Maryland high school and whose parents paid taxes for the last 3 years, they can pay in-state tuition. Investing in education of our kids benefits our state, our economy, and the young people who will get a shot at achieving their dreams. On November 6th, voters get a chance to determine the fate of some students in Maryland. It's important to vote. More information is available for ballot question 4 at educatingmarylandkids.org. We are joined here in studio by Dr. Kenneth Morgan. Ken Morgan is Assistant Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies at Coppin State University. Has been a frequent guest on the show over the years, and Ken, good to see you back in the studio. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Brian Griffiths is with us. He's also been a guest on the show many times. Brian is chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans, and Brian, welcome. Good to have you back with us as well.
Great to be back, Mark.
And I hear rumors there's a third guest popping up on my show tonight, and his name is Charles Robinson, who is Maryland State Maryland Public Television's lead reporter. Good to have you with us, Charles.
Hey, always a pleasure to be with you. I'm missing you, Mark.
Well, I'm not down there this year. I'm sorry, man. Just couldn't do it. Sorry, you know.
I'm sorry, too, because, you know, we always have fun at these.
Yes, we do. But we're going to have fun on the air together, and then we can talk about it later when you get back, too.
Very good. That'll be fine.
So there are a number of things that we are going to kind of wrestle with here. We'll take a couple steps backward and look at what happened a little bit at the Republican convention, what we expect to happen at the DNC. Talk about what these conventions really mean, because many people look at both of these things as kind of theater of politics as opposed to the real nitty-gritty of politics, though sometimes it filters in many ways. We'll look at that. But then we'll take a look at how these conventions affect the election itself, what happens in terms of all the arguments around the new voting regulations put in place by states all over the country, southern states and states that are have Republican governors. What happens with the now 10 million more people added to the 80 that will not be coming out to vote this year, they say? How does that affect our politics? How does money affect this political campaign? Democrats are struggling to raise money from the corporate world with Citizens United that opens up those floodgates. Republicans have raised $100 million from Wall Street and from coal and oil and other interests. So how's that going to affect this election and more? So we'll wrestle with all of that. And you know, and these things are theater. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. And it is theater in many ways. I mean, we were treated to some real theater at the Republican National Convention, Brian, when Clint Eastwood, who we all love, got up there and talked to President Barack Obama, or talked to a chair at any rate, and seemed to steal the thunder for the convention, but also is all people seem to be talking about.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, there's a fine line between genius and insanity, and honestly, I'm not quite sure which side of the line we were operating on with the Clint Eastwood bit, but clearly it resonated with the American people insofar as all of the activity you've seen with people talking about Eastwooding, which is taking a picture of an empty chair in a certain situation, and AMC even revamped their entire lineup for movies yesterday, show entire Eastwood movies due to interest. But that kind of goes back to the point you were making, Mark, about how, you know, generally speaking, conventions these days are theater organized. They're basically a 3-day infomercial for the parties and for the candidates. And it's been that way for a long time, certainly probably since the last time we had a convention where there was any doubt about the nominee, which was in 1976. And, you know, until such time as we get to the point where the Democrats or the Republicans have a contested nomination going into the convention, it's still going to be something that's stage managed by the parties and stage managed by, you know, by the nominees. So it wasn't a surprise to any of us. The Democratic convention will be the same way over the next 3 days, and until there's reason for that to change, it's going to be, you know, a 3-day infomercial for the parties every 4 years.
Dr. Kenneth Morgan, how do you see this? And your old friend Clint Eastwood, not really your friend.
Make my day. All right, I think that he's probably no more comedic or no more unserious than the rest of the speakers at the Republican convention, quite frankly. So I don't see much of a difference, you know, with all of this. I think you hit it. It is theatrics. The issues, the real issues don't get discussed. If they are talked about, they aren't talked about in any serious way and in any depth. And many times there are erroneous and just misstatements and inaccuracies. So what's the point?
Now, Charles, were you at the Republican convention as well?
No, I didn't go to the Republican convention this year, but, you know, I did watch it. And, you know, look, Mark, I've been going to political conventions since 1988 and have seen their evolution. Your guests are correct. These are scripted television shows. What makes it interesting, and you've been on the ground at these conventions before, it is not just what you see on television that goes on at these conventions, but it's the behind-the-scenes stuff that you don't get to see on television. So, like, to give you an example, in Tampa, there was a big breakfast held by the Koch brothers, and we found out about it because they invited a reporter, and they never told it was off the record, and they began to lay out the plan to basically thwart whatever the Obama administration was going to do in this election. Moved to here in Charlotte. There have been a number of meetings between various, like to give you an example, there was a big meeting this morning involving many of the delegates that they did strategizing, mapping of trying to find various electorates. This year, you know, I'm in an area where a lot of foreign press is, and we just heard from an Obama administration official who talked about something I had never heard about the creative class. These are the class of voters who are artisans, engineers, and folks who, you know, do extraordinary things. He was talking about the percentages that they got in the last election and how much of that percentage was going to be greater. So for those of you who are watching on television, yes, these are, you know, nothing's going to come as a surprise. But what I try and deliver to the audiences that, you know, hear my voice and watch me online is the insider stuff, the stuff that you're not going to see in the New York Times and the Washington Post. So, you know, of course, tonight's a big night for the state of Maryland. This is when the governor is going to give a keynote address. And, of course, the delegation can be as giddy as you can be. And I had to remind some folks, the last time this governor made a speech, I hate to tell you, it bombed. And the only reason you don't hear about it is because a guy named, and this happened in Boston when he was the mayor, that there was a guy at that convention by the name of State Senator Barack Obama. And nobody remembers what he said. But I had to go back and look through my notes. And you know what I remembered most about?
Yeah.
He said the word alabaster. And I was like, who says that?
So let's go to some of the phones here as well, 410-319-8888. But let's talk about some things here, and I want to get people's thoughts and ideas. I really do. I'm not setting this up. I mean, we'll see how many truths are extended into the realm of approaching lies in the DNC as they bring up their speakers. Some of the Democrats I know are very worried about Bill Clinton's speech because he hasn't shown it to anybody yet. I'm not sure what he's going to say on
good
his
luck on that one.
Economic
on
policy
that one.
Speech tomorrow night. So a lot of people who are nervous about that in the Democratic Party.
Will he have an empty chair?
Well, I don't think he'll have an empty chair. He might as a joke. You never know. But I don't think he'll have an empty chair. But I think that last week when we saw things like, I mean, what happens when people are manipulated with things that just aren't real? Wait just a second, Charles.
Brian,
let me as head of the Young Republicans kind of jump in, and then Ken can respond as well. But I mean, when I listened to Ryan, and I listened to his speech, the whole thing, on television, and when he said things like, when accusing President Barack Obama of stepping away from the commission. That, you know, to reform our taxes here in America, to reform the tax structure in America and the financing of government. And he put it on Barack Obama's plate. What he didn't say was, I walked away from that. I decided not to take part. I decided not to cooperate, even talk to Barack Obama about it, and I decided to walk away from the commission. Didn't say that. When those kind of things...
And he didn't say that, but you got to remember, Mark, one of the reasons that Paul Ryan stepped away from the commission and voted against the commission's proposal is because it didn't go far enough in addressing the issues of spending.
But if he had said that, that would have been the truth. But instead what he said was that Barack Obama torpedoed it, and I gave the inference that he had nothing to do with walking away from it.
You know, I mean, it's both sides play the game. And, you know, I know that, you know, as you guys said, you know, when the Democrats, you know, start lining up in Charlotte, you know, the same thing's going to happen. Over at Red Maryland, we're already prepared to handle the truth squad during Governor O'Malley's remarks, since we have a pretty vast experience of dealing with the things that Governor O'Malley says. But, you know, it's all part of – it goes back to the whole idea of the fact that it's a staged, managed endeavor, and it's a three – it's – each party has its own mechanism for – for detailing their plans and detailing what they want you to know about them and what they want you to know about their opponent. Now, thankfully, we live in an age where the internet has really democratized the process of, you know, providing verification, for providing counterpoints. And I know that the Democrats, you know, had a operation to counter Republican points during the convention. I can tell you the Republicans are loaded for bear tonight, ready to start, you know, taking apart the statements of Democrats that are being said tonight. And, you know, it's politics. Anybody is surprised by the fact that either side leaves out certain parts of the argument, you probably haven't been paying attention for very long. So, I mean, it's not really a surprise to anybody. So it's just part of the game.
Well, why should there be a game? It's not a game for the many people, the hundreds of thousands of people who are unemployed, those who don't have health care, those who are dispossessed, those who have lost their homes through foreclosure, and don't see a bright, cheery day, period. So I'm not exactly understanding why those things are not addressed in any significant way.
For the same reason that the administration hasn't addressed them in the last 4 years. I mean, the administration has been running on a very cheery record. It's not. It's don't confuse the act of governing with the act of winning an election. They are two very disparate things. For example, the Obama campaign was one of the most effective political operations that we've probably ever seen. The Obama administration has been one of the least effective political operations, one of the least effective administrations that we've ever seen.
The people
understand that they're not better off than they are 4 years ago, and it doesn't take either campaign or either party for people to recognize that. It's all a matter of framing the issue and putting the best face forward on the ability to show which party is best equipped to lead and how the lives of the people who have no jobs, people who are struggling, how their lives are going to improve. You know, it's not about – politics has never been about playing fair. So it's not – you know, that's just comes with the territory.
Brian, let me let Kenneth finish, and we'll bring Charles in. Go ahead, Brian. Kenneth.
Well, a lot of it is an oxymoron. If you're saying – and I'm not – if you listen to me, I'm not – I'm not sparing the Democrats or the Republicans. If it's theater, and if it can't be serious in a theater, in reference to some of these kinds of issues that exist, the ones that I've mentioned. For example, the biggest myth is that somehow government controls the economic system. I mean, that is ludicrous, quite frankly. But everybody, both the Democrats and Republicans, are insisting that somehow they have this formula for how to deal with what clearly is a crisis in capitalism. So where do you start with addressing those things?
Well, and so I want to come back to those kind of concrete things and raise some issues and see how either party is trying to address them. But Charles, let me let you jump in here, and we'll go to the phones.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say, I hope everybody who is listening to this discussion agrees with this simple philosophy, and mine is real simple. I want good government. I don't care who's in charge of it or how it works. I want good government, okay? That's just a simple kind of idea. And, yes, everybody has a point of view. But you don't get to kind of play with the facts if they're fast and loose. And everybody will decide, you know, which point to emphasize. One of the things that I think, you know, as a veteran political reporter is that, yes, I've seen the coarseness of the political discourse, and that it has sometimes bordered on a take-no-prisoners kind of concept, and I'm going like, that's not good government. You know, sometimes you can't, you know, look, if you're a bully in a schoolyard, one day the bully loses, okay? And the person who's, you know, who's the underdog becomes the top dog. But that's not what politics should be about. It should be about how can we make things work. And, you know, I get how, you know, one might perceive one idea different from the other. But I always remind folks, if you look up in the sky and you tell me the sky is brown, I'm going to tell you the sky is blue. And that's the most important part, that we have to establish a set of facts that we can measure things by.
So
at the end of the day, look, you know, this is a period in the political discourse of the United States. And trust me, this is not the most coarsest discourse. There are periods of time, as you know, Mark, and I guess your guests will know, where people actually pulled guns out and shot each other.
Right.
I hope we haven't gotten to that. I hope we haven't gotten to that.
The discourse in America, the political discourse, was much more heated and dangerous in the 19th century, even part of the 20th century, and across the 18th century. But having said that, let me open the phones because I just want to push some of this a little bit further. I mean, beyond the spin of Republican Republican ideological language in this, where the Democrats, if they were on the air representing their party, but they couldn't make it tonight because they're in Charlotte and couldn't get them out of the meetings, they'll be on tomorrow and bring the Republicans back with them. I'm going to hear what the people say. I'm going to raise some other issues around that. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Darren. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My critique of the political process is how poli-sci is taught. They don't teach people about governing in political science. In political science classes, they teach people about winning elections, and that's what it's become. It's boiled down to just can you win at all costs. But I'd like to remind people that liars don't lead; they mislead. So if your political if the people that you're calling your leaders are misleading people, you have to be concerned about the kind of leadership that they will be able to put forward.
And Darren, I appreciate the call. And I think, let me just, this is sort of what Darren was saying, because I think, and I was thinking about it in terms of what you were saying as well a moment ago, Brian, is that it is what politics has become. What we do, let me take that back. It is what the heart of national politics is, which are half-truths, half-stepping, lying, fabricating, and kind of turning people's words around to mean something they did not. And I think many people, Darren and many others in America, are tired of it. I mean, there's a reason why, and I'll raise this, and Ken, I'll let you jump in, then everybody can chime in. There's a reason, it's a poll I keep bringing up over and over again, and I'll bring it up again tonight, which was put out by the Suffolk University. Suffolk University had a poll of unlikely voters, both registered and unregistered voters, who are not voting because they feel not part of the process and don't feel that they have a voice in this country or government, and they're not voting. 90 million people will not vote, up from 80 last time. 43% of the people in that poll said they would vote for Barack Obama. The interesting number in that thing was 23% said they would consider a third party. I think there's a large body of people, even those voting, Ken Morgan, who are fed up with things as usual. They don't care if politics was dirty in the 19th century. They don't like what they're seeing now.
I think that's an excellent point. The one aspect of all of this, Mark, is that we all, in schools and every place else, we push this idea that your sovereignty or the power of the people is the power to vote. Well, I would have to history challenges that, quite frankly, objectively. If you look at the significant changes in this country, you would see that it doesn't come from who you elect, but from the people themselves, number one. So if you can have a party that's independent and does not just rely on electoral politics, but on an everyday basis organizes struggles to deal with specific issues. For example, why it seems to be simple if we need infrastructure, the schools, the roads, et cetera, why isn't either party proposing that have a jobs program to deal with this specific issue? If, for example, there's an issue with housing and people who cannot pay their mortgages, why not forestall or cancel those mortgages? This would be an independent perspective, independent of all of the kinds of politics and the integration of the corporate world with both the Democratic and Republican Party. It's a pretty simple answer, I think.
Brian, go ahead.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is, you know, you can't talk about one issue. Parties are not designed to succeed in the political system that we have. A one issue party can become a part of government in a parliamentary system like we see in Canada, or particularly like we see in Britain, where you have a whole list of parties who then are able to join and form a coalition government. One of the real reasons why independent parties and third parties, well, there's a couple reasons, and ballot access is one of them, and that's a whole different ball of wax. But the reason that an independent party doesn't succeed is because there's no basis and no groundswell of support for them. Mark, you quoted the number of voters who are unlikely voters, people who aren't going to participate in the process. It's really hard to have an impact on the game if you're sitting on the bench. And the best way, and I tell people this regardless of what party they are, what ideology, they have, the only way you're going to affect change is to suit up and get in there. Because if you're just sitting on the sidelines, nothing is ever going to change. It's incumbent on the parties themselves to try to grow their own bases, politically speaking, in order to give those folks a reason to rise up and become part of the process. But at the same time, when you talk about electoral politics, nobody cares about what the unlikely voters are going to do. The election is won among the likely voters and the swing voters among the likely voters. And does that create problems because you're focusing the election on trying to convince 4 million people in a nation of 315? Yeah, probably. But, until people become part of the process and try to change the process from within, it's not going to change with them sitting on the sidelines.
From within what?
I'm sorry?
From within what?
Either from within, from participating in the process, yeah. Joining a party, running for office.
If you identify all of the significant changes, the modern civil rights movement did not come from electing Kennedy or Johnson. It came from specifically struggle. Social Security, the eight-hour day. All of these kinds of things came from the masses of people putting pressure on the powers to be, not from the government and who you elect.
It seems, though, that the question that I was trying to get to here, then we have to take a break here. We'll come back and go back to the phones, and I want to hear from Russ and Mike and Lamar, the next three callers up. What that means in terms of what this poll says, and I want to hear what Charles thinks as well when we come back, what this poll says in terms of what it says about where the American electorate is, why they feel the way they do, why they feel so disenfranchised by this process. And there's Huffington Post, which once was a fairly liberal publication, now is kind of not sure what it is, but it has a lot of interesting articles on both sides of the fence these days, which I like. It says that one of the things, they have a series of articles now about neither party addressing what they think see are three essential issues in American political life. One is the corrupting influence of money in politics. Two is the persistence of poverty in America. And three is the disastrous war on drugs and how those affect America. And maybe we can wrestle with those a bit. But we had a short break and come back. We'll come back to Brian Griffiths, who is chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans. Am I taking it? You're not in Charlotte, are you?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No.
That's what I was checking. And Ken Morgan, who's here with us in the studio.
It's okay to be in Charlotte, Brian.
I've been in Charlotte, a lovely city, not really my scene this week.
Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies at our sister university, Coppin State. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here with Dr. Kenneth Morgan. Ken Morgan is a professor of interdisciplinary studies at Coppin State University.
And urban studies.
Excuse me, Ken. Sorry, I didn't leave anything out of it. Sorry, Ken. And Brian Griffiths, who's chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans. And you're still working in Red Maryland?
I am.
Okay, and we put that in there, too. As we always like to quip and joke, when you say that to people, it's not a communist publication, but a Republican publication. 410-319-8888. And you can join us here, right? Join us on Facebook. Let's go right to the phones, and we'll wrestle a bit with what I was saying earlier, but let's hear what some of our listeners are saying. Russ, you're on the air.
Mark, this is the first time in my adult life that I can recall or not recall the most recent past president, either party or vice president, being at a convention, let alone having a speaking role. They turned to Clint Eastwood. That speaks volumes in itself. But what I want to get at more than that is that, you know, man is indeed a thinking and reasoning animal. But I think I find agreement if I say that we are also feeling animals, we have emotions. And a political campaign, in general, appeals more to our emotions than our intellect. So I'm right. hoping for the next minute or two that you can give me that we can overmaster our emotions and take an intellectual look at this president from the record they say he can't run on, in particular jobs. Now, let's just put it this way. Let's say you're fortunate enough to own a business. You're the chairman of the board. You bring in the CEO to run your business. The CEO comes in, and over a 96-period month, he loses you $8 million to the $300,000 a month routinely with a high of $800,000. And then you look at it, and you see, oh, wait a minute. This guy's loss is policy more than economic conditions, because he's paying people tax breaks and other things to send the money overseas rather than keep it in the company. Okay, so his contract expires. After a wide search, you bring in a new CEO. And in a period of 42 months, what this new CEO has done, it's not just arrest the offshore traffic and brought us to equilibrium, but now, for the last 31 consecutive months, he's produced income at a rate of $120,000 to $140,000 a month, $4.2 million over 42 months, I should say. And so what they're asking me to do is fire this guy. Does that make sense?
Well, I think that Russ had to go. I mean, excuse me, Charles had to go cover a story at the convention, but I'm trying to get him back. So, Brian, as the in-house Republican tonight, why don't you jump in first? Let Ken go next.
Yeah, speaking of facts that don't really quite jive with the reality on the ground, you know, this president has done a terrible job of creating jobs. He did a terrible job of creating an economic environment that makes it easy for people to prosper and succeed. Not that, that just says nothing of the fact that this president has put $5.4 trillion to the deficit in just 4 years, which is more than the last, I believe, seven presidents combined, as far as adding to the deficit when you start talking about, you know, tax increases, the Obamacare expenditures, and the additional social programs. The fact of the matter is this. Not only are more people out of work, not only are taxes higher, not only has government grown, not only has capital continued to flow overseas, regardless of what your caller has said, the fact of the matter is that people are economically worse off than they were 4 years ago because of the job climate has not improved, because inflation has actually brought down the value of the dollar. And, you know, this president even said 3 years ago, in 2009, he said, if I don't get this, if I can't fix the economy, if I can't create a better jobs picture, this is going to be a one-term proposition. So, I mean, it seems to me the president has made the case himself as to why he needs to be replaced with somebody who's more experienced and can actually get our economy going again.
Well, I think both the incumbent and the person running in the Republican Party, I think misplace and provide inaccuracies in reference to what drives the economy. Number one, the government does not drive the economy. The last time I saw, we live in a market or capitalist system where the bottom line is what? Profit. And so you see now, in order to make profit, not lose profit, et cetera, there's a large number of people who are unemployed. This is what employers do. They lay off people or they try to cut back or make people work harder to produce profit for themselves. Why not start there in reference to what is a solution?
Well, I mean, I think part of the issue is I agree with one point, that the government does not create jobs and the government does not drive the economy. No. However, the government does a very good job of creating barriers to economic development, whether it be taxes, whether it be the size of a government, things that take capital out of the economy and make it harder and give reasons for capital not to be reinvested in new jobs, new factories, and new infrastructure. We've seen it time and time again. If you look at how much money is actually sitting on the sidelines, that there's sort of a capital strike going on right now where business owners and people who would be encouraged to create jobs and to create economic development are sitting on the sidelines waiting to see if this president is reelected. I believe that you're going to see a lot of capital freed up if Mitt Romney is elected president of the United States, because people now are going to realize that there's a climate that is better suited to economic development and economic growth with this president out of office.
The whole issue has historically been an issue whether there should be more government or less government. I mean, it's not anything that's quite frankly new. If you look at some of the economic woes, you look at the issue in the so-called Great Depression, you would see that the solution was supposed to be the Keynesian solution. I don't know if you're familiar with the Keynesian solution. But then when things were going kind of bad in the 80s, there was the supply side economics. There was a looming Milton Friedman. So all of these things related to the economics and the economy. Well, sure, the government can do something, but it is not the main and driving force of this economy. If anything, it seems as though government, both Republicans and Democrats, have appeased big business in reference to different kinds of things. For example, with so-called Obamacare, well, you don't. I would bet you that many of the health organizations, for-profit ones, are jumping for joy because they're going to have a supply and demand situation, or do have it. It's a part of the law. So, I mean, I don't quite understand the argument about how much of an influence government is. It's more so that how much government bends to corporate interests, it seems to me, and there's examples everywhere.
So let me go back to the phones here, and folks like to hear what you think. 410-319-8888, and with your thoughts, let's go to the phones, and I'll throw this question out, and Brian we can all wrestle when they come back. And let's say I'll play the Democratic side for a minute, since the one's here to do it right now. If it's always the case that government in politics and higher taxes don't grow an economy, in a capitalist economy, in our Western capitalist society, then why, at the time of its highest involvement, from 1945 to 1973, did the economy grow faster and bigger with lowest unemployment at the highest tax rate of any period in American history?
I can answer that question very easily. Europe was rebuilding. Asia was rebuilding after the war. We were the only game in town. All the economic development, all the industrial development in the West.
Well, I think that people say that. I think that's a much too simplistic response. I mean, there's a lot more to what government can do to supply the infrastructure of a nation. and build the free economy around that infrastructure, where the infrastructure is the grid, whether the infrastructure is the infrastructure of our cities and communities, where the infrastructure is our schools, our healthcare system, and allow the marketplace to flourish is another system that works. The problem is that's what Barack Obama promised to fight for when he got to the White House, and he didn't. I mean, there's other ways of looking at how a economy and a capitalist economy can work in the West.
Let me just ask a question here in reference to the bailout of General Motors. Would our Republican friends, Brian, would they agree or disagree with that tactic?
No, I mean there was absolutely no reason to bail out General Motors, and I know that you know there are some Republicans who voted for the bailout. There are some Republicans who voted for things like TARPA. It was an improper role of government to bail out a privately owned company, putting $800 billion of American dollars, taxpayer dollars, at risk just to keep a company afloat. A company that then proceeded under government stewardship to cut jobs, close dealerships, and really hasn't returned any great significant value on the investment. It was a bad idea all around. And the conservative perspective is that there is no business that is too big to fail. And it was not a well thought out strategy, and it should not have been done.
Let's go over the phones here. And I would rather respond right now, which I could, but 410-319-8888. Let's go to Mike. You're on the air. And then Lamar will be on. Mike?
Mark, as far as the comparison animals is concerned, where we are merely thinking animals, that's an insult to animals. And I think that the proper thing would be to have, instead of an empty chair, an empty bed, where Juanita Broderick could say something in response to Bill Clinton, put some ice on that, so that she could then give him an answer a la what Clint Eastwood gave. And that would be definite theatrics and comedy.
Okay.
And that's what needs to be done, something of, so Juanita Broderick can have a say, and Bill Clinton being up there with the full congratulations and desire by the Democratic Party.
All right. Thank you, Mike. 410-319-8888 is the number here.
I think the post-war war thing does have some merit. It's not the only reason, but for example, within that post-war between 1945 and 1973, it spawned the great civil rights, modern civil rights struggle, because black folks were pretty much left out of the situation, and so the response partly was to the whole issue of the segregation, the lack of job opportunities, all of the nine yards. And there's also we also assume in this situation that blacks and whites have different perspectives, and that somehow the middle class is the main class in the United States of America. Well, it's not. It's working people. And I think if you start from there, there's a lot of history that suggests that whites and blacks, working people, have the same some of the same kinds of interests. And so, I mean, it's important to understand that as well.
No, I agree. Economic interests transcend racial, religious, economic, any lines. Everybody, at the end of the day, everybody's got to buy a loaf of bread. And that bread's going to cost, the bread's going to cost the same thing, whether or not, you were poor or you're rich. And when you're talking about somebody who is living in the middle class, in the working class, somebody who's really concerned about their job loss, really concerned about being able to pay the tax bill that's coming due, that the issue of the cost of bread, becomes a very serious issue. So I would absolutely agree. Economic issues transcend any line.
410-319-8888, though I think you both see it from different perspectives, I'm sure it's true. Lamar, you're on the air in Baltimore County.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Actually, let me be very careful what I say. But
no, say what you got to say. Just keep it clean. Yeah. Just keep it clean. You'll be all right, Lamar. Go ahead. What you have to say.
Let me be very careful, because I don't want to give anybody a talking point, opportunity. But basically, it really doesn't matter if there's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. And here's why. Just using the simple model that Clinton used in 92, where it took him 6 years to balance the budget, using that same model where the debt is now triple what it was when he came out of office, we could just be audacious and say that it'll take 18 years to balance the deficit, to balance the budget. And this is with increasing taxes and spending $3 trillion extra dollars on the infrastructure over the next 10 to 12 years. As far as Social Security and Medicare, let's be realistic and let's be honest that Social Security is going to be supplemented by the private industry. Medicare is going to be supplemented by the private industry, which is why Obamacare, as they like to call it, but where you have to buy a public, an actual health plan. So that actually is going to supplement Medicare. So everybody's going to need a health care plan to supplement the Medicare because it's going to run out, as well as Social Security. So it just, we want to look at short-term wins. This issue is going to take Democrats and Republicans to sit down at the table and say, what are we going to do over the next 10 years? What are we going to do over the next 12 years, the next 18 years, and the next 40 years?
Right.
And that's the whole problem, that the politicians aren't being honest with us. I'm 40 years old. I plan on being broke for the next 30 years because this is going to be a rough 30 years simply because of decisions that were made over the past 12 years. To extend the Bush tax cuts, to cut taxes, to go to war. I mean, we basically tripled the debt in 12 years. It wasn't just Obama. And just to piggyback on what the other gentleman said about President Obama increasing the debt by $5.3 trillion, when he came into the office, the deficit was already $1.3 trillion. And that was going to stay that way over the next 2 years. So it was $11.3 trillion. They had to raise the debt to $14.3 trillion to cover the deficit over the next 2 years. And given the majority that they had, they basically said, okay, let's increase it by $3 trillion because the deficit was already in place. This is what Bush gave President Obama. So these are just facts. I know how to do the math, so little talking points they're not going to sway me either way.
You about to say something again?
No, go ahead.
Okay, let's go to getting the callers in here, and then we'll come right back to our guests at 410-319-8888. Johnny, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I know this is just a little idea.
Okay, go ahead.
To the point that Professor Morgan is talking about, if people were to go ahead and say the banks didn't deserve the bailout, let's go take 50% of all the money on pay, the masses truly would be making history and would make policy change. But through that disorganization of the people's actions, sometimes it happens, masses make a change, and sometimes the lack of organized action is the reason why we get played by any party saying that they're changing anything when they're not.
Did you all get that?
No, could you just explain a little more?
What I'm saying is if the people decided to take, I have two ideas. In South Africa, they had mass strikes, right? So if somebody used the internet and decided to go ahead and say, everybody take 50% of our deposits out, all the banks would go crazy. And then you would see policy change on both sides of the aisle. They would be in unison about what shouldn't happen.
Well, what would you attribute that to?
What would I attribute what to?
What you just said.
I'm just talking. That's why masses are the people do make the history.
Okay.
Just the disorganized action and how it can get played. If they're organized, it does change.
Okay. I think that one of the things is that.
An example that the reality is the banks have. We've been played by the politicians about the banks, but the people could actually take it into their control if they chose to take all their money out of the bank.
Well, I think there's people aren't, that's the only person, people, we have to talk about different kinds of people and corporations that have money and lending power and credit power and debt power, et cetera. So I think that it's really necessary to see who does have an influence. For example, there's an old joke that says if you owe the bank $100,000, the bank owns you. But if you owe the bank $1 billion, you own the bank. So I think that you have to look at where that, you know, where the revenue and sources of revenue and things come from.
If people withhold labor for a week, you would see a lot of change happen.
Well, this is one of the things with Caterpillar and some of the other strikes that haven't made the news. This is the power of which working people have, and that is to withhold their labor. And this is part of the historical labor movement. It's important to be able to understand that.
So, Brian, you want to jump in with your thought on what you just heard, the last couple callers?
I mean, clearly, you know, people have to rise up and do it. And sometimes it does require just one person, you know, the one-man majority, so to speak, to stand up and do something. I don't think that, I don't think a 50% withdrawal of bank holdings is going to do anything but create an economic disaster. First and foremost, that the politicians would have to first address. But, you know, anything that's small that's done on a local level, we were talking about the civil rights movement earlier, you know, it just takes one thing, you know, whether that's, you know, Rosa Parks sitting, you know, not giving up her seat on the bus, or the sit-in at Reed's drugstore, anything, you know, can start a movement. And it just takes one person with courage to start trying to make that change, but it's not going to be overnight, and it is a way for people to participate in the process. That is one way to affect the change.
And let me just, again, I'll throw this poll out, and I'm going to send you a copy of this poll, Brian. I'm curious to see your response to it, and I'm going to guess the people on here, Republicans, Democrats, and others, to kind of wrestle with this poll that I've been studying really intensely from Suffolk University. And what it says, when 59.4 million Americans, by this poll's numbers, and people can always, you know, find a reason why the poll's not accurate, but whatever that X number of people is, it's a big number, who are not voting, registered and unregistered, would have either voted for Barack Obama or voted third party. I don't know which third party, you look at the poll, divided between Greens, Libertarians, many other places. But so that says there's a huge amount of dissatisfaction. It also says whoever wins this election is winning really with a minority of Americans. And that says to me a lot about where we are as a country, that neither party, and not saying a third party will do it, maybe one of those parties will do it and they'll break up. Who knows what history will bring us in the coming years. But there's a huge amount of dissatisfaction in this country with the political process.
And I think that's very true. I was a part of something called the National Black Independent Political Party. And the race between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter in 1980. And so the premises on which that party was built was not just electoral. It was, what are we going to do about the oppression of black people, specifically in terms of jobs and health and the essentials of life?
Funny how those issues seem to have carried over in some ways.
Right. And so I would suggest, Mark, that since someone will say, well, this will take away the votes from the lesser of two evils. Then you have also the young man, it was Lamar, who talked about people withholding labor, for example. Why not have a real labor party with issues, not just economic issues, but social issues that affect the majority of people in this country? I think it's viable. Ask yourself this. Are there going to be substantial changes in the increase of quality of life for if Romney or Obama, President Obama, if Obama is President Obama is reelected, or if Romney is elected? Will there be substantial increases in the quality of life for the majority of people in this country?
What do you think, Brian?
I mean that. Kind of a loaded question for me. I, of course, of course life will improve with under a Romney presidency, and life will continue to degrade under an Obama presidency. You know, but it all goes back to the idea of people need to get involved, and if that's, you know,
there is a way to, and there's also, don't underestimate the ability to change from within. One of the most interesting aspects of this, of the Ron Paul phenomenon, has been their ability to participate in the Republican Party and change the party from within. So I think that, you know, it's there's an underestimating of the ability to use the current two-party system in order to affect the change that, that people want. The thing is this, you gotta, and I think this is what a lot of people, even particularly people who don't participate in the process, don't remember, is that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And that sometimes it takes a long time to enact the changes that, that people want, you know, want. And, you know, change is not instantaneous. And that the way to reform the system takes time. And
let me ask you both this question really fast before we have to take a break, which we have to do in a minute, but not just at this moment. We do have to take a break. We were going to do another segment coming up next with us on DocuBus. One of our guests for that segment has been arrested protesting in Charlotte. So we have like four callers online waiting to join us, I think. Do you guys want to stay around for a few more minutes?
Sure.
After the break? Sure. Can you? And we'll come right back. Let's continue our conversation. Don't go away, and then we will get the UnDocuBus guys. They will, women and men. They'll be coming on in a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. mecu.com for Baltimore's credit union. We are still here, joined by Brian Griffiths, chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans, and Dr. Kenneth Morgan, assistant professor of interdisciplinary studies and urban studies at Coppin State University. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go right to the phones. Folks have been holding on for a while. We'll go to Dorsey, then Bernard. Dorsey, you're on the air. Dorsey, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
What I would like to comment about... Everybody is talking about Obama bashing. Why is Obama supposed to be able to do something so great in one term that hasn't been accomplished in the last 20 years? The President of the United States is basically a spokesman. He has people that he answers to. Why nobody ever said anything about when Bush was in office, when they're talking about they're looking for weapons of mass destruction? They haven't found any weapons of mass destruction yet. And all these people have lost their lives for nothing. For what? Because they're trying to take control of the oil. All the Muslims that they have arrested in Guantanamo Bay, what were they guilty of? Being the majority of them just being Muslims.
You're breaking up, Dorsey.
Excuse me?
You're breaking up.
I'm breaking up?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, can't hear you.
Can't hear you.
I'm in my car. Let me pull over, because I want to get this across. Hold on one second.
Yeah, don't hurt yourself, please.
Right. It sounds like you're on expressway.
I don't want to hurt yourself, man. We want to keep all our voters alive in America, you know? go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Now, they're over there looking for weapons of mass destruction, right? Have they found any weapons of mass destruction? No, because that was not their objective. Their objective is, what are the Bushes? They come from Texas. They're oil tycoons. They're trying to take control of the oil. Petroleum is a major force in the economy of this world, not only the United States. So I think that everybody should take a good look at what's going on around them. And those of you who have the right to vote, vote. And do not get discouraged by these people. So now all of a sudden you need identification to vote. When have they ever done that in the history of this country? People have lost their lives to allow us to have the right to vote. The poor and disadvantaged, get out and vote and fight. And if they don't, before long, it's going to be an uprising in this country. And I think that's the only thing that's going to make the powers that be take notice. Have a blessed day.
Thank you, Dorsey. Let's go back to the call, and we'll come back to our two guests. 410-319-8888. I'm sorry. Were you saying something, Brian?
No, I got nothing.
410-319-8888. Bernard, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark.
Welcome.
It really makes me angry when I hear Republicans say they shouldn't have bailed out General Motors. The Brian, I mean, just think. General Motors, they don't make car. I mean, tires. General Motors don't make radio. Look at the domino effect of General Motors, the government hadn't bailed out General Motors. I mean, how can you say not to bail out a major industry in this country? We don't have any that many anyway. They're all overseas. And if Brian would look in the mirror, he would realize why we don't have any jobs. It's the people that look like him who sent them overseas.
If I was sending jobs overseas, I'd miss quite a few paychecks. But here, the point of this, though, is this. You have the opportunity for good-paying labor to go work for another car company. There's more than one car company in this country, and they sell fine automobiles. And there is a plenty of labor that could go work for Ford, for Toyota, for Mazda, for any of these companies. There are jobs for people who can do good work and good people who are skilled, particularly with their hands. And we're actually finding a shortage of people who are skilled in working in mechanics and with their hands.
But folks
might be able to find work. And the fact of the matter is you had an $800 billion bailout that went to cover costs that were done by, you know, everybody wants to talk about how the corporations are the ones that are mismanaging their money and they're all the problems. They're the ones that got them in the mess in the first place. So the fact is you sent $800 billion to General Motors in order to cover the mistakes that a corporation
General Motors,
made.
General Motors has paid the money back, and General Motors, as a company, is doing a lot better. General Motors is doing a lot better.
General Motors is not really doing that well, which is why they've had to actually they were forced into selling the Volt, among other things, you know, by the government creditors. That's problem number one. You know, and General Motors is very, very far away from being back.
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you something.
What would you have done if we hadn't bailed General Motors and the tire manufacturers start laying off? The people who make the radios to go into the car, the people put the seats in the car, the battery people make the battery for. What would you have said? What would you have done there? Unemployment would have been a lot higher.
Ken,
disagree.
Ken?
No. Well, first of all, the idea of economics and the idea of that historically there has been always how much should government be involved and not be involved in the economy. That has been historic, but it has always been involved. There's a book that folks should read by Beard to talk about the looking at the Constitution as an economic document. Which has a lot of merit. So I don't want to be talking about whether General Motors is doing well or not. I want to be talking about whether the everyday person is doing well and what can be done to enhance the wellness of those persons. Once you transfer this argument to the corporations and what whether they're doing well or whether they're doing are not doing well, what is left out of the equation are everyday working people. And everyday working people aren't doing well. They aren't doing well not just because President Obama is in office. They're doing well because there is an economic crisis not caused by the government but caused by the crisis in capitalism. And that is part of the issue that no one wants to address.
Let's go back to the phones and thank you for your call. 410-319-8888. Jason, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark. It's Jason Timmel. How are you?
Very well. Welcome, Jason. Good to have you with us, man.
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to make a comment specifically to your young Republican guest relating to the poll you cited about the public's disenfranchisement with the political system in general. There's probably blame on both sides of it, but one thing that I think has been crystallized in this election is that the Republican Party as a brand has changed and shifted massively in the last 10 years. There was a time when you had people like Jack Kemp within the party. It was a real pariah, you know, back in the early, late 80s and early 90s, because he would bring new and fresh ideas to the table. The idea, I don't know if you remember when he was the secretary of HUD, but he was the one that championshiped a concept of ownership, that if you gave Title VIII housing titles to the people that lived in them and they had pride in their own property, it would change. And that was battled back and forth within the party, but he ended up being the vice presidential nominee under Bob Dole. This is a party right now that is allergic to intellectual debate. It's completely antithetical to thought, and the health care issue is a perfect example. I invite anyone on this program listening to YouTube Newt Gingrich and Individual Mandate, and you can see proof positive that the entire thinking behind the Affordable Health Care Act was a very, very conservative idea. It was thought of by the Republicans as a way to make sure that freeloaders didn't get across on the government. And now you've got Republicans arguing just as ferociously against this concept because there's a total void of thought. And Mitt Romney had to watch every single person in the Republican field leave the party before he won the nomination because the party's lost and fractured and allergic to good thinking. And in order to have a two-party political system, you have to have an exchange of ideas.
Well, let me let Brian Griffiths respond. Brian, go ahead.
Well, of course, I couldn't disagree with that anymore. Obviously, you know, it's very hard to make the argument that the Republican Party is anti-intellectual, particularly after citing the example of Jack Kemp, considering the prominence a young Jack Kemp staffer has reached, considering Jack Kemp's intellectual heir is Paul Ryan, the next vice president of the United States. I think it's just not correct at all to say that the Republican Party is devoid of intellectual ideas, any more so than, you know, you want to talk about a shift in the Republican Party. We've seen just as radical a shift in the Democratic Party, moving extremely far to the left and far outside the American mainstream, particularly in issues of economics and freedom issues, particularly when you start talking about the HHS mandate, which is probably the worst thing that we've seen in government in a long time, you know, where we're talking about mandating government-funded abortions for organizations that don't even, you know, are ideologically opposed and morally opposed to such things. It's just not accurate to say that the Republican Party is anti-intellectualism. I would argue it's the exact opposite. The Democratic Party is more in line with lockstep dogma than the Republican Party is.
Brian,
let me ask you a question.
Go ahead, Jason. We have to move on. Go ahead.
You've got pro-life and pro-choice folks that are prominent all over the Democratic Party. Don't you believe that being pro-choice in the Republican Party is a disqualifier on the main public stage? Do you believe in your heart?
Your premise is flawed because the Democrats have run everybody who's pro-life out of the party. I mean, that is just a flawed premise. Bob Ehrlich was a pro-choice Republican. There are many pro-choice Republicans, particularly Northeastern Republicans. The ideological big tent, particularly on the issues of abortion, is on the Republican side, I hate to say.
Well, if they were, then Condoleezza Rice would be the vice presidential candidate.
You ain't lying about that, and they wouldn't have.
Well,
I mean,
that's
Paul Ryan's position. Wouldn't have changed the morning that he got nominated. Because the problem you had is that his position on abortion was exactly the position. It was more to the right of Todd Akin, and you couldn't admit it, and you didn't want to say it. And that shows you that there is not a Big Ten in the party any longer.
I mean, it's Todd Akin's position on abortion has little to do with anything that Paul Ryan has to do. Todd Akin said something stupid and should have left the ticket. I mean, that's just an ideologically disingenuous argument to try to tie one idiot to the entire ticket.
Let me let Ken Morgan come back into the conversation.
Well, I hear both talking, and all I hear is men who didn't agree with what is a right to a woman's body in terms of abortion. So what's the bottom line here? Who's deciding who has the right to a woman's body, and that is the woman herself.
Well, I mean, nobody's really asked about the life of the infant. That's really kind of a problem there. Everybody seems to be concerned about the perceived right of a woman to have an abortion. When in reality, you're talking about a live human being who is killed in the process of an abortion.
Well, that's a matter of debate, though.
And that's not just a matter of debate. It's also a legal, social construct. It's you know, there's no there are different times when different people have struck down laws in reference to the different aspects of when life is comes into being. So it can be a law, period, to invoke these other kinds of things. There's a bunch of foolishness, and to not look at the rights of women and the control of their body is also a bunch of foolishness. And pretty much the Democrats have bended to this thing, and so have Republicans. So where does the women's control of her body come into existence here for both parties?
Well, women have the right to not engage in the activity that leads to pregnancy. I mean, that's very simple. And by the way, there's this whole issue.
Doesn't
about
it take
women.
Two to tango?
Hold on. There's this issue about women which really frustrates me, and it frustrates a lot of my female Republicans who seem to think there seems to be this idea that women all around the country are in lockstep with this idea that that they should be pro-abortion just like the Democrats are, and it's just not true. The fact of the matter is that you have a life involved here. Whether you agree with it or not, whether it's legal or not, doesn't make it moral and doesn't make it
all right. But the question is, the majority of women in America do support the right to choose, even though there's a lot of room where people might agree or disagree about when and how and what. And that is reality. And that thing, I think, just to clear up before we go and get one more quick caller in here, then we're going to go to our next guest, is that whether you agree or disagree with President Barack Obama's health care law, and I have a lot of issues with it myself, as we've outlined in this program, he didn't say the Catholic Church or any other church has to pay for an abortion. He said that any insurer of any institution, hospital, or anyplace else, people who insure that hospital in that insurance have to pay for a woman's right to abortion if she chooses one. So he wasn't saying...
Exactly, which of course creates a crisis of conscience for the Catholic Church, who, by the way, is the largest private health care provider in the United States.
He's saying for the employees. He's not saying the Catholic Church has to. And churches are actually not in this. Someone who works inside the church itself, that's not required.
Yes, but we're talking about Catholic charities, which are organized.
You're talking about somebody who may not be a Catholic, who works for a Catholic-owned institution, has the right to choose.
And they made a choice to work for a Catholic institution. They're so Catholic not be forced to violate their morals.
In a marketplace where there are very few jobs, you have to take a job where you can get it.
Well, that's a choice, too.
And the Catholic Church has a right to work in civil society and has to make a choice as well. To work in civil society or not.
The problem is the net result of Obamacare is going to be pretty much the withdrawal of the Catholic Church from the healthcare industry, which is going to have even worse of an effect on the healthcare industry than Obamacare is.
Well, we have our next guest in, but let me go to Julie for a final thought from a woman. But we only have like 1 minute, Julie. Go ahead, then we have to go. Julie, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we don't have much time, so just go ahead and say what you have to say.
Republicans have become so right-wing that even St. Reagan would not have been allowed in it. Jerry Goldwater would have been considered a liberal. And I happen to work for Catholic Charities, and what I do with my body is not their business. I work for them, and one of my benefits is my insurance. And I guess that's all I have to say because you're out of time. Thanks. Bye.
Julia, I'm sorry we couldn't get you earlier, and I want to thank both my guests. It's been a really interesting conversation. And well thought out from both of our guests. Dr. Brian Griffiths, it's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Chairman of the Maryland Young Republicans, also who writes or edits for Red Maryland. Dr. Ken Morgan, he's laughing because he is Red Maryland. Assistant Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies and Urban Studies at Coppin State University. Always good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, Mark.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a 10-second break and come back with Aura Bogado, who writes for Color Lines, to talk about the DocuBus that's made its way to the Democratic National Convention. Stay with us.